Welcome to Historical Nerdery, the show that destroys the myths of the American Revolution, one podcast at a time. I am your head nerd, Alexander Kane. On today's episode, we are going to explore the politics of 18th century Lexington and learn just how this small dairy town went from peacefully resisting English crown economic policies to openly preparing for war with England. I hope you will join us today on Historical Nerdery. Let's get into the show. The origins of the American Revolution can be traced back to the close of the French and Indian War in 1763. Following its conquest of Canada, England began to recognize the harsh realities of its victory. In the months following the Treaty of Paris, England was forced not just to administer its newly acquired territories, but also to defend them. This necessitated maintaining a 10,000-man army to protect North America from future French operations and Native American attacks, such as Pontiac's Rebellion, which ignited at the conclusion of the French and Indian War. By January 5, 1763, England's funded debt was a staggering £122 million, with an annual interest of £4 million. A year later, the debt was almost £7 million larger, and by January of 1767, it had increased another £7 million. In an attempt to curb this financial burden, the English government implemented a series of economic programs aimed at having those it considered to have benefited the most by the successful conclusion of the war, the American colonies. And England felt that the American colonies should share in the burden of the debt. After reviewing the state of England's finances, Chancellor George Grenville concluded that the American colonies had benefited greatly from the protection of the crown while contributing very little in taxes. At the same time, Grenville pointed out an active smuggling trade coupled with massive colonial customs mismanagement, particularly in the New England region, had led to an annual £6,000 deficit in customs duties collected in the American ports. Accordingly, he suggested that a direct tax be levied on the American colonies in order to generate additional revenue. The first two revenue-raising measures were the Sugar Act of 1767 and the Stamp Act of 1765. The Sugar Act established tariffs on colonial trading and also attempted to curb the American practice of smuggling sugar and molasses from the West Indies by placing a 3 pence per gallon tax on foreign molasses. The Act established a list of enumerated goods that could be shipped only to England, including lumber, and set forth procedures for the accounting, loading, and unloading of cargo in port. Violations of the Act were prosecuted in a vice admiralty court where defendants would be denied the right to a jury trial and where the presumption was of guilt rather than innocence. The second revenue-raising measure was the Stamp Act, which levied an unprecedented direct tax on almost every piece of public paper in the colonies. Newspapers, almanacs, deeds, wills, custom documents, even playing cards were among the many papers subjected to the tax. The Stamp Act went so far as to impose a tax upon tax receipts. Of course, the Sugar and Stamp Acts brought on an explosion of riots, boycotts, and protests throughout the American colonies, particularly in Massachusetts. At first, Massachusetts' response was peaceful. However, resistance to the taxes soon became more violent. Under the guidance of Samuel Adams, Bostonians began a campaign of terror directed against those who supported the Stamp Act. It began on August 14, 1765, with an effigy of Andrew Oliver, the appointed stamp distributor for Massachusetts, being hung from a liberty tree in plain view by the Sons of Liberty. That evening, Oliver's luxurious home was burned to the ground. Understandably, Oliver quickly resigned his commission. But the following evening, incited by a rumor that he supported the Stamp Act, the home of Thomas Hutchinson, the lieutenant governor of Massachusetts Bay Colony, was surrounded by an unruly mob. When Hutchinson refused to accede to the demands that he come out and explain his position on the Stamp Act, the mob broke several windows and then dispersed. But 2 weeks later, on August 28, 1765, an even larger mob assembled and descended upon the homes of several individuals suspected of favoring the Stamp Act, including again that of Lieutenant Governor Hutchinson. Hutchison managed to evacuate his family to safety before the mob arrived. Then, as Hutchison later described, "The hellish crew fell upon my house with the rage of devils, and in a moment with axes split down the door and entered. My son heard them cry, 'Damn him, he is upstairs, we'll have him.' Some ran immediately as high as the top of the house. Others filled the rooms below and cellars, and others remained without the house to be employed there. I was obliged to retire through yards and gardens to a house more remote, where I remained until 4 o'clock, by which time one of the best finished houses in the province had nothing remaining but the bare walls and floors." The mob's show of force had the desired effect. With Oliver's resignation, the stamps could not be properly distributed. Additionally, no one else was willing to step forward to assume Oliver's legal role. In short, Boston, as well as Massachusetts Bay Colony, was crippled and could not enforce the Stamp Act. Lexington, being both close in proximity and tied economically to Boston, quickly became embroiled in the stamp crisis. A town meeting was held on October 21, 1765, to address the stamp question and determine what instructions should be given to William Reed, the representative of Lexington to the Massachusetts General Court. A committee was established, composed of selectmen James Stone, Thaddeus Bowman, Robert Harrington, Benjamin Brown, and Samuel Stone, Jr. Supervised by the Reverend Jonas Clark, the committee drafted a series of instructions. Although stopping short of challenging Parliament's right to pass laws regulating the American colonies, the instructions and resolutions from Lexington did challenge the perceived results of the act. According to the resolution, Lexington declared, "What of all most alarms us is an act commonly called the Stamp Act, the full execution of which we apprehend would divest us of our most charter rights and privileges, rob us of our character as free and natural subjects, and almost everything we ought as people hold dear." Admitting that there was no dispute as to the right of Parliament to impose such an act upon us, yet we cannot forbear complaining of it in itself considered as unequal and unjust and a yoke too heavy for us to bear, and that not only as it falls heaviest on the poor, the widow, and the fatherless, and the orphan, not only will it embarrass the trade and business of this infant country, but more especially, it will quickly drain the country of little cash remaining in it, strip multitudes of their property, and reduce them to poverty. The committee further asserted that the act was in violation of the basic rights and liberties guaranteed to them as Englishmen, an opinion shared by many of the residents of Massachusetts. The prevailing view in Massachusetts, and by extension Lexington, during this crisis, was that the power to tax rested not with Parliament, but with the colony's general court. The resolution from Lexington also chastised Parliament for its decision to eliminate the right to a jury trial by transferring prosecutions to admiralty courts. According to the resolution, Lexington declared, "By this act, we are most deeply affected, as hereby we are debarred of being tried by juries in case of any breach or supposed breach of it, a right which until now we have held in common with our brethren in England. This, we apprehend, will open a door to numberless evils which time can only discover." Yet Lexington was not Boston. The citizens of this small dairy town rejected the use of violence and rioting. The town resolutions even went to great lengths to discourage violence and declared that they earnestly recommended the most calm, decent, and dispassionate measures for our open, explicit, and resolute assertion and vindication of our charter rights and liberties. "We take it for granted, therefore, that you will carefully avoid all unaccustomed and unconstitutional grants which will not only add to the present burden, but make such precedents as will be attended with consequences which may prove greatly to the disadvantage of the public." With the riots receiving widespread coverage in London newspapers, coupled with the successful boycott programs undertaken by New York, Pennsylvania, and Massachusetts, England finally yielded. Realizing the Stamp and Sugar Acts could never be enforced in America, the acts were repealed on March 4, 1766. However, before striking the laws, Parliament announced the Declaratory Act of 1766, which emphasized its authority to legislate for the colonies in all cases whatsoever. It was not long before members of Parliament made use of the principles expressed in the Declaratory Act. In 1767, England was faced with a projected annual cost of almost £400,000 to maintain her army in America. Charles Townshend, the impetuous chancellor, of whom it was said his mouth often outran his mind, suddenly announced that he knew how to tax the American colonies. To meet this financial crisis, Townshend suggested Parliament agreed to a series of laws directed at raising revenue from the American colonies. The Townshend Acts, as they became known, provided for an American import tax on paper, painter's lead, glass, and tea. The act also tightened custom policies and revised the dreaded Vice Admiralty Courts. This so pleased the House of Commons that they promptly voted to lower English land taxes from 4 shillings on the pound to 3, resulting in a £500,000 loss of revenue and threatening fiscal chaos. Although a minority within the House of Commons opposed such a measure, the majority rationalized it would raise colonial revenue, punish colonists for their ill behavior after the repeal of the Stamp Act, and exercise the rights to which Parliament laid claim in the Declaratory Act. Once again, Boston stood at the forefront of opposition. On October 28, 1767, the citizens of Boston resolved at a town meeting to oppose the acts by refusing to import English goods and to encourage American manufacturing instead. Lexington quickly followed Boston's initiative. On December 28, 1767, Lexington voted unanimously to concur with the town of Boston, respecting importing and using foreign commodities as mentioned in their votes. However, by 1768, Boston was once again resorting to violence in its opposition to British policy. In March, rioters went to Commissioner Birch's home, and with clubs assembled before his door a great part of the evening, and he was obliged to send his wife and children out by a back door. Customs Inspector William Wooten returned home on the evening to find 4 men passing him, one with a stick in his hand, and they accosted him, saying, "Damn your blood, we will be at you tomorrow night." The victims of the mob begged Governor Bernard to apply for military protection so that the Townshend Acts could be enforced. The governor struggled with the decision, but ultimately applied to the king for troops. At the same time, however, British merchants pleaded with Parliament and the king to repeal the act before they were brought to financial ruin. Yet unfortunately, their pleas went unanswered. In 1768, Governor Bernard was forced to dissolve Massachusetts' colonial legislature, and 2 full British regiments were dispatched to Boston to protect custom officials and help enforce the Townshend Act. Lexington's inhabitants reacted with dismay. On September 21, 1768, they assembled to take into their serious consideration the distressed state of the province at the present day and to pass any vote thereto. Isaac Bowman, William Reed Esquire, and Deacon James Stone were selected to prepare reasons for our present conduct. After much consideration and deliberation with the Reverend Clark, these 3 men presented a series of resolves to the town. In particular, they appealed to the Massachusetts Royal Charter for the authority to forthrightly defend their rights as Englishmen. The residents of Lexington, through their resolves, argued that it was explicitly stated in the Massachusetts Charter that as inhabitants of the colony, they possessed certain rights, liberties, and privileges therein, among which it is granted, established, and ordained that all and every your subjects of them, their heirs and successors, which shall go to inhabit within said province and territory, and every of their children, which shall happen to be born there, shall have and enjoy all the liberties and immunities of free and natural subjects, as if they and every one of them were born within the realm of England. However, Lexington went on to assert that the freeholders and other inhabitants of the town of Lexington will, at their utmost peril of their lives and fortunes, take all legal and constitutional measures to defend and maintain your person, family, crown, and dignity of our said sovereign lord, George III, and all in singular the rights, liberties, privileges, immunities granted in said royal charter, as being those which are declared to be belonging to us as British subjects. The resolves of 1768 represented a departure from the town's earlier position as stated during the Stamp Act crisis. Gone was the tone of deferential disagreement, along with the expressed desire to avoid the violence that had plagued Boston. No longer was the argument focused primarily on the economic impact of British taxation policies. Although stopping short of justifying a resort to arms, the 1768 Lexington Resolves demonstrated the town's unwavering devotion to their constitutional rights and its willingness to defend those liberties at all costs within legal bounds. The residents noticed a change in the tone as well. The report was actually debated and read several times before it was finally accepted with a unanimous vote. Still, Lexington knew they had taken a momentous step forward, and now they could not turn back. At the conclusion of the town meeting, the town voted to keep a day of prayer on the occasion and left to the Reverend Mr. Clark to appoint the time. The town also adopted a boycott of all British goods. Women were organized into spinning bees to decrease the dependence upon imports. According to one newspaper article from August 31, 1769, very early in the morning, the young ladies of Lexington, to the number of 45, assembled at the house of Mr. Daniel Harrington with their spinning wheels, where they spent the day in the most pleasing satisfaction, and at night presented Mrs. Harrington with the spinning of 602 knots of linen and 346 knots of cotton. If any should be inclined to treat such assemblies or to the publication of them in a contemptuous sneer as thinking them quite ludicrous, such persons would do well first to consider what would become of one of our so much boasted manufactures on which we pretend the welfare our country is so much depending. Instead of reestablishing law and order, the Townshend Acts only provoke further violence. On March 5, 1770, an angry mob began to badger and taunt a lone British sentry on guard duty in front of the Boston Custom House. When the crowd began to pelt him with snowballs, ice, and other objects, he called for help and was reinforced by a squad of soldiers from the 29th Regiment of Foot. The crowd pressed closer, and the nervous regulars opened fire. Five men in the crowd were killed, and a number of others were wounded. The soldiers were arrested, tried, and all but two were acquitted. The Boston Massacre, as the incident became known, sparked widespread outrage and pushed the colonies dangerously close to rebellion. To forestall an uprising, Parliament retreated, repealing all of the Townshend Acts except for a symbolic tax on tea, of which no immediate attempt was made to collect. However, in 1773, Parliament passed the Tea Act in an attempt to finally collect the tax on tea and to refinance the shaky economic base of the British East India Company. Established in 1709, the British East India Company derived over 90% of its profits from the sale of tea. However, by 1772, due to severe mismanagement of the company, it was in desperate need of a bailout. The company directors naturally looked to Parliament for relief. Parliament's response was the Tea Act, through which the East India Company was given the exclusive rights to ship tea to America without paying import duties and to sell it through their agents to American retailers. American merchants, who for years had purchased tea from non-British sources, faced the prospect of financial ruin. Massachusetts immediately opposed the act and began to organize resistance. On November 29, 1773, the tea ship Dartmouth arrived at Griffin's Wharf in Boston. 3 days later, the Beaver and the Eleanor arrived at the same wharf. Bostonians demanded that Governor Hutchinson order the three ships back to England. On December 16, 1773, the owner of the Dartmouth apparently agreed with the recommendation and went to Hutchinson to beg him to let the ships return to England. However, Hutchinson refused, and at approximately 6 o'clock that evening, some 150 men and boys disguised as Indians marched to the three ships, boarded them, and dumped 340 chests of tea into Boston Harbor. Meanwhile, as tempers boiled over in Boston, the citizens of Lexington assembled actually 3 days prior to the Boston Tea Party to discuss the unfolding events. matter was referred to the town's committee of correspondence, which quickly drafted an emotional and stinging condemnation of the Tea Act. The committee also issued 6 resolves pledging to preserve and protect the constitutional rights that Parliament had put into jeopardy, to boycott any teas sent out by the East India Company or that shall be imported subject to a duty imposed by Act of Parliament, to treat as enemies anyone found aiding in the landing, selling, or using of tea from the East India Company, and to treat the merchants of the East India Company with contempt. Finally, the town expressed its gratitude to Boston for its undertaking in the name of liberty and pledged, "We are ready and resolved to concur with them in every rational measure that may be necessary for the preservation or recovery of our rights and liberties as Englishmen and Christians. And we trust in God that should the state of our affairs require it, we shall be ready to sacrifice our estates in everything dear in life, yea, in life itself, in support of the common cause." Upon completion, the town of Lexington, with a unanimous vote, adopted the resolves. And immediately afterwards, an additional resolve was drafted by the Reverend Clark and passed, warning the residents of Lexington that if any head of family in this town or any person shall, from this time forward and until the duty was taken off, purchase any tea, use or consume any tea in their families, such person shall be looked upon as an enemy to this town and to this country, and shall by this town be treated with neglect and contempt. Following this political activity, that same evening on December 13, 1775, the residents of Lexington gathered all tea supplies within the town and proceeded to burn them. According to one Boston newspaper account, "We are positively informed that the patriotic inhabitants of Lexington unanimously resolved against the use of tea of all sorts, Dutch or English, and to manifest the sincerity of their resolution, they brought together every ounce contained in the town and committed it to one common bonfire." The resolves of Lexington reflected the general political mood throughout the American colonies on the eve of the American Revolution. Many Lexington residents, as well as American colonists, believed that a set of corrupt and mysterious men had been able to assert control over George III, his ministers, and his favorites through bribery and deceit. Most Americans were certain that powerful men were plotting to make colonist slaves by curtailing their liberties as Englishmen. The common belief emerged that an immoral British government, having exhausted opportunities for plunder and profit in England and Ireland, was now seeking a dispute with the American colonies as an excuse to enslave and deprive them of their wealth and liberties. Parliament had hoped to accomplish this goal quietly, but the furor arose in the colonies by England's economic policies had given the government a temporary setback. Now, these mysterious men who controlled Parliament and the King's ministers were undertaking to openly incite a war, declare Americans as rebels, and enslave them. As early as 1772, Lexington was expressing apprehension that "our charter rights and liberties are in danger. We are clearly of the opinion that the plan of oppression is begun and so far carried on that if our enemies are still successful and no means can be found to put a stop to their career, we have just reason to fear that the eyes of the head of government being blinded, the sources of justice poisoned, and the hands of administration bribed with interest, the system of slavery will soon be complete." Of course, the Boston Tea Party was viewed in England as so rebellious an act of defiance that it could not be ignored. As a result, the English Parliament adopted several harsh and restrictive measures aimed at punishing Massachusetts, most particularly Boston. On March 31, 1774, King George III signed the Boston Port Bill, intended to severely reprimand rebellious Boston. The port was closed to all seagoing traffic until damages for the destroyed tea were paid in full. The Massachusetts Provincial Charter of 1691, which residents of the Massachusetts Bay Colony viewed as a sacred guarantee of their liberties, was revoked. Additional regiments of regulars were dispatched to Boston, and Major General Thomas Gage replaced Thomas Hutchinson as governor. Gage moved the seat of government from Boston to Salem, Massachusetts, and the customs office was moved from Boston to Plymouth. The governor's council was replaced with a non-elective mandamus council, and town meetings were prohibited without the consent of the governor. Finally, jury trials were completely abolished. To the citizens of Massachusetts, it was clear that the British government had thrown down the gauntlet. Passage of these intolerable acts, as they became known, was seen as the most blatant attempt by England to provoke a war. Throughout the American colonies, committees of correspondence toiled to spread this message and increase opposition to Parliament. Towns adopted covenants asserting their opposition to British attempt to crush their rights, while in Middlesex and Essex counties of Massachusetts, towns ordered its courts to refrain from conducting business. On October 5, 1774, Lexington's Deacon Stone was in Salem along with his fellow representatives to the General Court. When General Gage attempted to arbitrarily adjourn the General Court, the representatives voted, including those of Lexington, to make the Massachusetts Provincial Congress the governing body of the colony in order to promote the true interests of His Majesty in the peace, welfare, and prosperity of the province. Any hope of avoiding a civil war now seemed dashed. On September 26, 1774, Lexington voted to form committees whose responsibilities were to bring two pieces of cannon from Watertown and to mount them, to provide a pair of drums for the use of the military company in the town, and to have the militia and alarm list for a view of their arms. In Boston, General Hugh Earl Percy correctly surmised the state of affairs in Lexington as well as Massachusetts on the eve of the American Revolution. Things here are now drawing to a crisis every day. They have taken up arms in almost every part of this province and have drove in the governor in most of the council. A few days ago, they mustered about 7,000 men at Worcester. In short, this country is now in an open state of rebellion. I hope you have enjoyed today's episode of Historical Nerdery. To learn more about the battles of Lexington and Concord, as well as other neat information about revolutionary New England, be sure to check out my website, historicalnerdery.com, follow me on Facebook and Instagram, and subscribe to my mailing list. I'm Alex Kane, and this has been Historical Nerdery.